reassert some authority. If you have evidence against the Ravkins, the Tidemaker spoke from behind her mask of mist. The Ravkins have nothing to do with this. The money was transferred to the shoe. Vanek blinked, then changed tack. Well then, Brekker struck some kind of deal with the shoe. Instantly, the shoe were shouting their denials, but the Tidemaker's voice was louder.
The false fund was created by Johannes Rietveld and Jan van Eck.
Van Eck's face went white. No, that's not right.
Rietveld is a farmer, stammered Carl Dryden. I met him myself.
The Tidemaker turned on Dryden.
Both you and Jan van Eck were seen meeting with Rietveld in the lobby of the Geldrenner Hotel.
Yes, but it was for a fund. A Gerda consortium, an honest business venture.
Rodmacher, said Van Eck. You were there. You met with Rietveld.
Rodmacher's nostrils flared.
I know nothing of this Mr. Rietveld.
But I saw you. We both saw you at the Geldrenner. I was there for a presentation on Zemini oil futures. It was most peculiar, but what of it?
No, said Van Eck, shaking his head. If Rietveld is involved, Brekker is behind it. He must have hired Rietveld to swindle the council.
Every one of us put money into that fund at your encouragement, said one of the other councilmen. Are you saying it's all gone?
We knew nothing of this,
countered the shoe ambassador.
This is Brekker's doing, insisted Van Eck.
His smug demeanor was gone, but his composure remained intact.
The boy will stop at nothing to humiliate me and the honest men of this city. He kidnapped my wife, my son.
He gestured to Kaz.
Did I imagine you standing on Godmed Bridge in West Stave with Alice?
Of course not. I retrieved her from the market square just as you asked,
Kaz lied, with a smoothness even Matthias found convincing.
She said she was blindfolded and never saw the people who took her.
Nonsense! Said Van Eck dismissively.
Alice!
He shouted up to the western balcony where Alice was seated, hands folded over her high, pregnant belly.
Tell them!
Alice shook her head, her eyes wide and baffled. She whispered something to her maid, who called down.
Her captors wore masks, and she was blindfolded until she reached the square.
Van Eck released a huff of frustration.
Well, my guard certainly saw him with Alice.
Men in your employ, said Rodmacher skeptically.
Brekker was the one who set up the meeting at the bridge, said Van Eck. He left a note at the lake house.
Ah, said Rodmacher in relief.
Can you produce it?
Yes, but it wasn't signed.
Then how do you know it was Kaz Brekker who sent the note?
He left a tie pin.
His tie pin?
No, my tie pin, but...
So, you have no proof at all that Kaz Brekker kidnapped your wife?
Rodmacher's patience was at an end.
Is the business with your missing son as flimsy? The whole city has been searching for him. Rewards have been offered. I pray your evidence is stronger on that account.
My son?
I'm right here, father.
Every eye in the room turned to the archway by the stage. Weiland leaned against the wall. His face was bloodied, and he looked barely able to stand.
Gason's hand, complained Van Eck beneath his breath. Can no one do their jobs?
Were you relying on Pekka Rollins, men?
Kaz mused in a low rasp.
And are you sure they were Pekka's men? If you're not from the barrel, you might find it hard to tell lions from crows. One animal is the same as the next.
Matthias couldn't help the surge of satisfaction he felt as he saw realization strike Van Eck. Kaz had known there was no way to get Weiland into the church without Van Eck or the Dime Lions finding out, so he'd staged a kidnapping. Two of the dregs, Annika and Keeg, with their armbands and fake tattoos, had simply strolled up to the Stadtwatch with their captive and told the men to fetch Van Eck. When Van Eck arrived in the chapel, what did he see? His son held captive by two gang members bearing the insignia of Pekka's Dime Lions. Matthias hadn't thought they'd rough Weiland up quite so badly, though. Maybe he should have pretended to break sooner.
Help him! Rademacher shouted to a Stadtwatch officer. Can't you see the boy is hurt?
The officer went to Weiland's side and helped him limp to a chair as the medic hurried forward to attend him.
Weiland Van Eck? Said Rademacher.
Weiland nodded.
The boy we've been tearing apart the city searching for? I got free as soon as I could.
From Brecker?
From Rollins.
Pekka Rollins took you captive?
Yes, said Weiland. Weeks ago.
Stop your lies, hissed Vanek. Tell them what you told me. Tell them about the Rovkins.
Weiland lifted his head wearily.
I'll say whatever you want, Father. Just don't let them hurt me anymore.
A gasp went up from the crowd. The members of the Merchant Council were looking at Vanek with open disgust. Matthias had to stifle a snort.
Has Nina been giving him lessons? He whispered.
Maybe he's a natural, said Kaz.
Brecker is the criminal, said Vanek. Brecker is behind this. You all saw him at my house the other night. He broke into my office.
That's true, said Carl Dryden eagerly.
Of course we were there, said Kaz. Vanek invited us there to broker a deal for Kuwei Yulbo's indenture. He told us we'd be meeting with the Merchant Council. Pekka Rollins was waiting to ambush us instead.
You're saying he violated a good-faith negotiation? Said one of the councilmen.
That seems unlikely.
But we all saw Kuwei Yulbo there too, said another. Though we did not know who he was at the time.
I've seen the poster offering a reward for a shoeboy matching Kuwei's appearance, Kaz said. Who provided his description?
Well, the merchant hesitated, and Matthias could see suspicion warring with his reluctance to believe the charges. He turned to Vanek, and his voice was almost hopeful when he said,
Surely you didn't know the shoeboy you described was Kuwei Yulbo.
Now Carl Dryden was shaking his head, less in denial than disbelief.
It was also Vanek who pushed us to join Rietveld's fund.
You were just as eager, Vanek protested.
I wanted to investigate the secret buyer purchasing Gerda Farms in Novi Zem. You said...
Dryden broke off, eyes wide, mouth hanging open.
It was you! You were the secret buyer!
Finally, muttered Kaz.
You cannot possibly believe I would seek to swindle my own friends and neighbors, Vanek pleaded. I invested my own money in that fund. I had as much to lose as the rest of you.
Not if you made a deal with the shoe, said Dryden.
Rodmacher banged his gavel once more.
Jan Vanek, at the very least, you have squandered the resources of this city in pursuing unfounded accusations. At the worst, you have abused your position as a councilman, attempted to defraud your friends, and violated the integrity of this auction.
He shook his head.
The auction has been compromised. It cannot go on until we have determined whether any member of the council knowingly channeled funds to one of the bidders.
The shoe ambassador began yelling. Rodmacher banged his gavel. Then, everything seemed to happen at once. Three Fjärden Druskala surged toward the stage and the Stadwatch rushed to block them. The shoe soldiers pushed forward. The tide makers raised their hands and then, over all of it, like the keening cry of a woman in mourning, the plague siren began to wail. The church went silent. People paused, their heads up, ears attuned to that sound, a sound they had not heard in more than 7 years. Even in Hellgate, prisoners told stories of the Queen's Lady Plague, the last great wave of sickness to strike Ketterdam, the quarantines, the sick boats, the dead piling up in the streets faster than the body men could collect and burn them.
What is that? Asked Kuwei.
The corner of Kaz's mouth curled.
That, Kuwei, is the sound that death makes when she comes calling.
A moment later, the siren could not be heard at all over the screaming as people shoved toward the church's double doors. No one even noticed when the first shot was fired.
34. Nina. The wheel spun. Golden-green panels whirring so fast they became a single color. It slowed and stopped, and whatever number came up must have been a good one, because the people cheered. The floor of the gambling palace was uncomfortably warm, and Nina's scalp itched beneath her wig. It was an unflattering bell shape, and she'd paired it with a dowdy gown. For once, she didn't want to draw attention. She had passed unnoticed through her first stop on West Stave, and through her second... Then she'd crossed over to East Stave, doing her best to move unseen through the crowds. They were thinner due to the blockades, but people would not be kept from their pleasures. She'd made a visit to a gambling palace just a few blocks south of this one, and now her work was almost done. Kaz had chosen the establishments with care. This would be her fourth and final destination. As she smiled and whooped with the other players, she opened the glass case in her pocket and focused on the black cells within it. She could feel that deep cold radiating from it, that sense of something more, something other that spoke to the power inside her. She hesitated only briefly, recalling too clearly the chill of the morgue, the stink of death. She remembered standing over the dead man's body and focusing on the discolored skin around his mouth. As she'd once used her power to heal or rend skin, or even place a flush in someone's cheeks, she had concentrated on those decaying cells and funneled a slender sheath of necrotic flesh into the compressed glass case. She tucked the case into a black velvet pouch. And now, standing in this raucous crowd, watching the happy colors of the wheel spin, she felt its weight, dangling from her wrist by a silver cord. She leaned in to place a bet. With one hand, she set her chips on the table. With the other, she opened the glass case. "Wish me luck," she said to the wheel broker, allowing the open bag to brush against his hand, sending those dying cells up his fingers, letting them multiply over his healthy skin. When he reached for the wheel, his fingers were black.
"Your hand," exclaimed a woman. "There's something on it."
He scrubbed his fingers over his embroidered green coat, as if it were simply ink or coal dust. Nina flexed her fingers, and the cells crawled up the broker's sleeve to the collar of his shirt, bursting in a black stain over one side of his neck, curling under his jaw to his bottom lip. Someone screamed, and the players backed away from him as the broker looked around in confusion. Players at the other tables turned from their cards and dice in irritation. The pit boss and his minions were moving toward them, ready to shut down whatever fight or problem was disrupting gameplay. Hidden by the crowd, Nina swept her arm through the air, and a cluster of the cells jumped to a woman beside the wheel broker wearing expensive-looking pearls. A black starburst appeared on her cheek, an ugly little spider that rippled down her chin and over the column of her throat.
"Elena,"
her heavy-set companion shouted.
"Your face!"
Now the screams were spreading, as Elena clawed at her neck, stumbling forward, searching out a mirror as the other customers scattered before her.
"She touched the broker. It got her, too."
"What got her?"
"Get out of my way."
"What's happening here?"
the pit boss demanded, clapping a hand on the baffled broker's shoulder.
"Help me,"
the broker begged, holding up his hands.
"There's something wrong."
The pit boss took in the black stains on the broker's face and hands, backing away quickly. But it was too late. The hand that had touched the broker's shoulder turned an ugly purplish black. And now the pit boss was screaming, too. Nina watched the terror take on its own momentum, careening through the floor of the gambling hall like an angry drunk. Players knocked over their chairs, stumbling toward the doors, grabbing for chips even as they ran for their lives. Tables overturned, spilling cards, and dice clattered to the floor. People raced for the doors, shoving one another out of the way. Nina went with them, letting herself be carried by the crowd as they fled the gambling hall and lurched into the street. It had been the same at every one of her stops, the slow bleed of fear that crested so suddenly to full-blown panic. And now at last she heard it, the siren. Its undulating wail descended over the stave, rising and falling, echoing over the rooftops and cobblestones of Ketterdam. Tourists turned to one another with questions in their eyes, but the locals, the performers and dealers and shopkeepers and gamblers of the city, were instantly transformed. Kaz had told her they would know the sound, that they would heed it like children called home by a stern parent. Kerch was an island, isolated from its enemies, protected by the seas and its immense navy. But the two things its capital was most vulnerable to were fire and disease. And just as fire leapt easily between the tightly packed rooftops of the city, so plague passed effortlessly from body to body, through the thick crowds and cramped living spaces. Like gossip, no one knew exactly where it began or how it moved so quickly, only that it did, through breath or touch, carried on the air or through the canals. The rich suffered less, able to stay sequestered in their grand houses or gardens, or flee the city entirely. The infected poor were quarantined in makeshift hospitals on barges outside the harbor. The plague could not be stopped with guns or money. It could not be reasoned with or prayed away. Only the very young in Ketterdam didn't have a clear memory of the Queen's Lady Plague, of the sick boats moving through the canals piloted by body men with their long oars. Those who had survived it had lost a child or a parent or a brother or a sister, a friend or a neighbor. They remembered the quarantines, the terror that came with even the most basic human contact. The laws addressing plague were simple and ironclad. When the siren sounded, all private citizens were to return to their homes. The officers of the Stadtwatch were to assemble at separate stations around the city. In case of infection, this was a means of attempting to keep it from spreading to the entirety of the force. They were dispatched only to stop looters, and those men were given triple pay for the risk of policing the streets. Commerce halted, and only the sick boats, body men, and medics had free rein of the city.
I know the one thing this city is more frightened of than the shoe, the Fjordans, all the gangs of the barrel put together.
Kaz had gotten it right. The barricades, the blockades, the checks on people's papers, all of it would be abandoned in the face of the plague. Of course, none of these people were properly sick, thought Nina, as she sped back through the harbor. The necrotic flesh would not spread beyond what Nina had grafted onto their bodies. They would have to have it removed, but no one would grow ill or die. At worst, they'd endure a few weeks of quarantine. Nina kept her head lower, her hood up. Though she had been the cause of it all, and though she knew the plague was pure fiction, she still found her heart racing, carried into a gallop by the hysteria bubbling up around her. People were crying, shoving, and shouting, arguing over space on the brow boats. It was chaos. Chaos of her making.
I did this, she thought wonderingly. I commanded those corpses, those bits of bone, those dying cells. What did that make her?
If any Grisha had ever had such a power, she'd never heard of it. What would the other Grisha think of her? Her fellow corporalki, the heart-renders and healers.
We are tied to the power of creation itself, the making at the heart of the world.
Maybe she should feel ashamed, maybe even frightened. But she hadn't been made for shame.
Perhaps Jell extinguished one light and lit another.
Nina didn't care if it was Jell or the Saints or a brigade of fire-breathing kittens. As she hurried east, she realized that for the first time in ages, she felt strong. Her breath came easy. The ache in her muscles had dimmed. She was ravenous. The craving for Perem felt distant, like a memory of real hunger. Nina had grieved for her loss of power, for the connection she'd felt to the living world. She'd resented this shadow gift. It had seemed like a sham, a punishment. But just as surely as life connected everything, so did death. It was that endless, fast-running river. She dipped her fingers into its current, held the eddy of its power in her hand. She was the queen of mourning, and in its depths, she would never drown.
35. Inej. Inej saw the snap of Dunyasha's hand and heard a sound like a wing beat, then felt something bounce off her shoulder. She caught the silver star before it could fall to the roof. Inej had come prepared this time. Jesper had helped her sew some of the padding from one of the hotel suite's mattresses into her tunic and vest. Years on the farm darning shirts and socks had made him surprisingly handy with a needle, and she was not going to play pincushion for the white blade again. Inej leapt forward, speeding toward her opponent, sure-footed on this roof she'd spent so very many hours on. She hurled the star back at Dunyasha. The girl dodged it easily.
My own blades would not betray me so, she chided, as if scolding a small child. But Inej hadn't needed to hit her, merely distract her. She flicked her hand,
as if she was throwing another blade, and as Dunyasha followed the movement, Inej rebounded off the metal spine to her right, letting the ricochet carry her past her opponent. She crouched low, knives in hand, and slashed open the mercenary's calf. Inej was up again in moments, bouncing backward over one of the scrollwork spines of the church, keeping her eyes on Dunyasha. But the girl just laughed.
"Your spirit brings me pleasure, Wraith. I can't imagine the last time anyone drew first blood on me."
Dunyasha leapt onto the scrollwork spine, and now they faced each other, both with blades at the ready. The mercenary lunged deeply, slashing out, but this time Inej did not let herself follow the instincts she had fought so hard to learn on the streets of Ketterdam. Instead, she responded as an acrobat would. When the swing was coming at you, you didn't try to avoid it. You went to meet it. Inej ducked close into Dunyasha's reach, as if they were partners in a dance, using the motion of her opponent's attack to knock her off balance. Again, Inej struck out with her blade, slicing open the girl's other calf. This time, Dunyasha hissed. "Better than a laugh," thought Inej. The mercenary whirled, a compact movement, spinning on her toes like a dagger on its point. If she felt any pain, she did not show it. Her hands held two curved blades now, moving in sinuous rhythm as she stalked Inej along the metal spine. Inej knew she could not move into these blades. "So, break the rhythm," she told herself. She let Dunyasha pursue her, giving up ground, skittering backward along the spine until she saw the shadow of a tall finial behind her. She feinted right, encouraging her opponent to lunge forward. Instead of checking the feint and keeping her balance, Inej continued to let herself fall to the right. In the same movement, she sheathed her blades and seized hold of the finial with one hand, swinging her body around to the other side. Now, the finial was between them. Dunyasha grunted in frustration as her blades clanged against metal. Inej leapt from scroll to scroll, racing over the roof to the thickest of the metal spines, following it up the humped back of the cathedral. It was like walking on the fin of some great sea creature. Dunyasha followed, and Inej had to respect that her movements were just as smooth and graceful, with two bleeding calves.
"Are you going to run all the way back to the caravan, Wraith? You know it's only a matter of time before this ends, and justice is done." "Justice? You are a murderer and a thief. I was chosen to rid this world of people like you. A criminal may pay my wages, but I have never taken an innocent life."
That word sounded a discordant note inside Inej. Was she innocent? She regretted the lives she'd taken, but she would take them again to save her own life, the lives of her friends. She'd stolen. She'd helped Kaz blackmail good men and bad. Could she say the choices she'd made were the only choices put before her? Dunyasha approached, the flame of her hair bright against the blue sky, her skin nearly the same ivory as the fine clothes she wore. Somewhere far below their feet, the auction continued in the cathedral, its participants unaware of the battle being waged above. Here the sun shone bright as a freshly minted coin. Wind rushed over the spines and spires of the rooftop in a low moan. Innocence. Innocence was a luxury, and Inej did not believe her saints demanded it. She drew her knives once more. "Sankt Vladimir. Sancta Alina. Protect me." "They're charming," Dunyasha said, and pulled two long straight blades from the sheaths at her waist.
"I will give my new knife a handle from your shin bone. It will be your honor to serve me in death."
"I will never serve you," said Inej. Dunyasha lunged. Inej stayed close, using every opportunity to keep inside the mercenary's guard and deny her the advantage of her longer reach. She was stronger than she'd been when they'd faced each other on the wire, well-rested, well-fed. But she was still a girl trained on the streets, not in the towers of some shoe monastery. Inej's first mistake was a slow recoil. She paid for it in a deep slash to her left bicep. It cut through the padding and made it hard to keep a good grip on the blade in her left hand. Her second error was putting too much force into an upward jab. She leaned in too far and felt Dunyasha's knife skim her ribs. A shallow cut that time, but it had been a close thing. She ignored the pain and focused on her opponent, remembering what Kaz had told her. Find her tells. Everyone has them. But Dunyasha's movements seemed unpredictable. She was equally comfortable with her left and right hands. She favored neither foot and waited until the last moment to strike, giving no early indication of her intent. She was extraordinary. Growing weary, Wraith. Inej said nothing, conserving her energy. Though Dunyasha's breathing seemed clear and even, Inej could feel herself dragging slightly. It wasn't much, but it was enough to give the mercenary the advantage. Then she saw it. The slightest hitch of Dunyasha's chest, followed by a lunge. A hitch, then another lunge. The tell was in her breathing. She took in a deep breath before an attack. There. Inej dodged left, struck quickly, a rapid jab of her blade to Dunyasha's side. There. Inej attacked again, and the blood flowered on Dunyasha's arm. Inej drew back, waited as the girl advanced. The mercenary liked to hide her direct assaults with other movement, the whirl of her blades, an unnecessary flourish. It made her hard to read, but there! The quick burst of breath. Inej sank low and swept her left leg wide, knocking the mercenary off balance. This was her chance. Inej shot to her feet, using her upward momentum and Dunyasha's descent to shove her blade under the leather guard protecting the girl's sternum. Inej felt blood on her hand. As she wrenched the knife free and Dunyasha released a shocked grunt. The girl stared at her now, clutching her chest with one hand. Her eyes narrowed. There was still no fear there, only a hard, bright resentment, as if Inej had ruined an important party. The blood you spill is the blood of kings, seethed Dunyasha. You are not fit for such a gift. Inej almost felt sorry for her. Dunyasha really believed she was the Lance of Air, and maybe she was. But wasn't that what every girl dreamed? That she'd wake and find herself a princess? Or blessed with magical powers and a grand destiny? Maybe there were people who lived those lives. Maybe this girl was one of them. But what about the rest of us? What about the nobodies and the nothings, the invisible girls? We learn to hold our heads as if we wear crowns. We learn to wring magic from the ordinary. That was how you survived when you weren't chosen. When there was no royal blood in your veins, when the world owed you nothing, you demanded something of it anyway. Inej raised a brow and slowly wiped the blood of kings on her trousers. Dunyasha snarled and launched herself at Inej, slashing and jabbing with one arm, the other pressed to her wound, trying to stanch the bleeding. She'd obviously been trained to fight with just one hand. But she's never had to fight with an injury, Inej realized. Maybe the monk skipped that lesson. And now that she was wounded, her tell was even more obvious. They had neared the tip of the church's main spine. The scrollwork was loose in places here, and Inej adjusted her footing accordingly, dodging Dunyasha's onslaught easily now, bobbing right and left, taking small victories, a cut here, a jab there. It was a war of attrition, and the mercenary was losing blood quickly. "You're better than I thought," Dunyasha panted, surprising Inej with the admission. Her eyes were dull with pain. The hand at her sternum was slick and red. Still, her posture was erect, her balance steady, as they stood mere feet from each other, perched on the high metal spine. "Thank you," Inej said. The words felt false in her mouth. "There is no shame in meeting a worthy opponent. It means there is more to learn. A welcome reminder to pursue humility." The girl lowered her head, sheathed her knife. She placed a fist over her heart in salute. Inej waited, guard up. Could the girl mean it? This wasn't the way you ended a fight in the barrel. But the mercenary clearly followed her own code. Inej did not want to be forced to kill her, no matter how soulless she seemed.
"I have learned humility," Dunyasha said, head bowed. "And now you will learn that some are meant to serve, and some are meant to rule."
Dunyasha's face snapped up. She unfurled her palm and released a sharp gust of air. Inej saw a cloud of red dust and recoiled from it. But it was too late. Her eyes were burning. What was it? It didn't matter. She was blind. She heard the sound of a blade being drawn and felt the slash of a knife. She bobbled backward along the spine, fighting to keep her footing. Tears streamed down her face as she tried to wipe the dust from her eyes. Dunyasha was nothing but a blurry shape in front of her. Inej held her blade straight out, trying to create distance between them, and felt the mercenary's knife cut across her forearm. The blade slid from Inej's fingers and clattered to the rooftop. Sancta Alina, protect me. But perhaps the saints had chosen Dunyasha as their vessel. Despite Inej's prayers and penance, maybe judgment had come at last. I am not sorry, she realized. She had chosen to live freely as a killer, rather than die quietly as a slave. And she could not regret that. She would go to her saints with a ready spirit, and hope they would receive her. The next slice cut across her knuckles. Inej took another step backward, but she knew she was running out of room. Dunyasha was going to drive her right over the edge. I told you, Wraith, I am fearless. My blood flows with the strength of every queen and conqueror who came before me. Inej's foot caught the edge of one of the metal scrolls. And then she understood. She didn't have her opponent's training or education. Or fine white clothes. She would never be ruthless, and she could not wish to be. But she knew this city inside out. It was the source of her suffering, and the proving ground for her strength. Like it or not, Ketterdam, brutal, dirty, hopeless Ketterdam, had become her home, and she would defend it. She knew its rooftops the way she knew the squeaky stairs of the slat, the way she knew the cobblestones and alleys of the stave. She knew every inch of this city like a map of her heart. The girl who knows no fear, Inej panted as the mercenary's shape wobbled before her. Dunyasha bowed. Goodbye, Wraith. Then learn fear now before you die. Inej stepped aside, balancing on one foot, as Dunyasha's boot came down on the loose piece of scrollwork. If the mercenary had not been bleeding, she might have taken better heed of the terrain. If she had not been so eager, she might have righted herself. Instead, she slipped, tipped forward. Inej saw Dunyasha through the blur of her tears. She hung for a moment, silhouetted against the sky, toes seeking purchase, arms outstretched with nothing to grasp, a dancer poised to leap, eyes wide, and mouth open in surprise. Even now, in this last moment, she looked like a girl from a story, destined for greatness. She was a queen without mercy, a figure carved in ivory and amber. Dunyasha fell silently, disciplined to the last. Inej peered cautiously over the side of the roof. Far below, people were screaming. The mercenary's body lay like a white blossom in a spreading field of red. May you make more than misery in your next life, Inej murmured. She needed to move. The siren still hadn't sounded, but Inej knew she was late. Jesper would be waiting. She sprinted across the cathedral's rooftop, back over Gazan's thumb to the chapel. She grabbed the climbing line and Jesper's rifle from where she'd lodged it between two pieces of scrollwork. As she scaled the dome and ducked her head into the orange chapel, she could only pray she was not too late. But Jesper was nowhere to be found. Inej craned her neck, searching the empty chapel. She needed to locate Jesper. Kuei Yulbo had to die tonight.
36. Jesper. The Council of Tides had arrived in all their splendor, and Jesper couldn't help but be reminded of the Comedie Brute. What was this whole thing but a play Kaz had staged with that poor sucker Kuei as the star? Jesper thought of Wylan, who might finally see justice for his mother, of his own father waiting in the bakery. He was sorry for the fight they'd had. Though Inej had said they'd both be glad to know where they stood, Jesper wasn't so sure. He loved an all-out brawl, but exchanging harsh words with his father had left a lump in his gut like bad porridge. They'd been not talking about things for so long that actually speaking the truth felt like it had broken some kind of spell. Not a curse, but good magic. The kind that kept everyone safe. That might preserve a kingdom under glass, until an idiot like him came along and used that pretty curio for target practice. As soon as the tides were moving up the aisle, Jesper stepped away from the Zemini delegation and headed toward the church's thumb. He kept his movements slow and his back to the guards who lined the wall, pretending he was trying to get a better view of the excitement. When he reached the arch that marked the entrance to the thumb nave, he directed his steps toward the cathedral's main doors as if to exit. "Step back, please," said one of the Sodwatch grunts, keeping polite for the foreign visitor, even as he stretched his neck to see what was happening with the Council of Tides. "The doors must be kept clear."
"I am not feeling well," Jesper said, clutching his stomach, laying on a bit of a Zemini accent. "I pray you let me pass."
"Afraid not, sir." "Sir?" Such civility for anyone who wasn't a barrel rat.
"You don't understand," Jesper said. "I must relieve myself urgently. I had dinner last night at a restaurant. A Stin Stockpot?"
The grunt winced. "Why would you go there?"
"It was in one of the guidebooks."
In fact, it was one of the worst restaurants in Ketterdam, but also one of the cheapest. Since it was open at all hours and so affordable, Stin's was one of the few things barrel thugs and Stodwatch officers had in common. Every other week, somebody reported some nasty trouble with his gut, thanks to Stin and his saint-forsaken stockpot. The grunt shook his head and signaled to the Stodwatch guards at the arch. One of them trotted over. "This poor bastard went to Stin's. If I let him out the front, the captain's bound to see him. Take him through the chapel?"
"Why the hell would you eat at Stin's?"
the other guard asked.
"My boss doesn't pay me well," said Jesper.
"Sounds familiar," the guard replied, and waved him toward the arch. "Sympathy, camaraderie. I'm going to pretend to be a tourist more often," Jesper thought. "I can forego a few nice waistcoats if the grunts go this easy on me." As they passed beneath the arch, Jesper noted the spiral staircase built into it. It led to the upper arcade, and from where he'd have a clear view of the stage. They'd promised not to let Kuwe walk into a disaster on his own, and even if the kid was a troublemaker, Jesper wasn't going to let him down. Discreetly, Jesper consulted his watch as they made their way toward the chapels at the end of the thumb. At four bells, Inej would be waiting atop the orange chapel's dome to lower down his rifle.
"Oh,"
Jesper groaned, hoping the guard would pick up his pace.
"I'm not sure I'm gonna make it."
The guard made a small sound of disgust and lengthened his strides.
"What did you order, buddy?"
"The special."
"Never order the special. They just reheat whatever they had left over from the day before." They arrived at the chapel, and the guard said, "I'll let you through this door. There's a coffee house across the way."
"Thanks,"
said Jesper, and looped his arm around the guard's neck, applying pressure until his body went limp. Jesper slipped the leather straps from around his wrists, secured the guard's hands behind his back, and stuffed the kerchief from his neck into the guard's mouth. Then he rolled the body behind the altar.
"Sleep well," Jesper said.
He felt bad for the guy. Not bad enough to wake him up and untie him, but still. He heard a boom from the cathedral and glanced down the length of the nave. Because the thumb of the church was built at a slightly higher level than the cathedral, all he could see were the tops of the heads of the audience's back rows. But it sounded like the tides were making quite a ruckus. Jesper checked his watch once more and headed up the stairs. A hand seized hold of his collar and hurled him backward. He hit the floor of the chapel hard. The wind knocked completely out of him. His attacker stood at the base of the stairs, looking down at him with golden eyes. His clothes were different from when Jesper had seen him exit the House of the White Rose on West Stave. Now, the Kerguj soldier wore an olive drab uniform over his vast shoulders. His buttons gleamed, and his black hair had been pulled back in a tight tail, revealing a neck as thick as a ham. He looked like what he truly was, a weapon. "Glad you dressed for the occasion," Jesper gasped, still trying to regain his breath. The shoe soldier inhaled deeply, nostrils flaring, and smiled. Jesper scrambled backward. The soldier followed. Jesper cursed himself for not taking the Stodwatch grunt's gun. The little pistol was no good for distance shooting, but it would have been better than nothing with a giant staring him down. He leapt to his feet and sprinted back down the nave. If he could make it to the cathedral, he might have some explaining to do, but the shoe soldier wouldn't attack him in the middle of the auction. Would he? Jesper wasn't going to find out. The soldier slammed into him from behind, dragging him to the ground. The cathedral seemed impossibly far away. The clamor from the auction and the Council of Tides a distant echo bouncing off the high stone walls. Action and echo, he thought nonsensically as the soldier flipped him over. Jesper wriggled like a fish, evading the big man's grip, grateful he was built like a heron on a strict diet. He was on his feet again, but the soldier was fast despite his size. He flung Jesper against the wall, and Jesper released a yelp of pain, wondering if he'd broken a rib. "It's good for you. Jogs the liver." He couldn't think straight with this oaf manhandling him. Jesper saw the giant's fist draw back, the gleam of metal on his fingers. They gave him real brass knuckles, he realized in horror. They built them into his hand. He ducked left just in time. The soldier's fist struck the wall beside his head with a thunderous crack. "Slippery," said the soldier in heavily accented Kurch. Again he inhaled deeply. "He caught my scent," Jesper thought. "That day on the stave. He doesn't care that he might be found by the Stodwatch. He's been hunting, and now he's found his quarry." The soldier drew his fist back again. He was going to knock Jesper senseless. And then, what? Bash down the chapel door and carry him along the street like a sack of grain? Hand him off to one of his winged companions? At least I'll never be able to disappoint anyone again. They would dose him full of Purim. Maybe he'd live long enough to make the shoe a new batch of Kurgood. He dodged right. The soldier's fist pounded another crater into the church wall. Now the giant looked angry. He pinned Jesper by the throat and hauled back to strike a final time. 1,000 thoughts jammed into Jesper's head in a single second. His father's crumpled hat. The gleam of his pearl-handled revolvers. Inej standing straight as an arrow. "I don't want an apology." Wylan, seated at the table in the tomb, gnawing on the edge of his thumb. "Any kind of sugar," he said. "And then, keep it away from sweat, blood, saliva, the chemical weevil." Inej had dumped the unused vials on the table in the Ketterdom suite. He fidgeted with one when he and his father were arguing. Jesper's fingers fumbled in his pants pocket, hand closing over the glass vial. "Purim," Jesper blurted. It was one of the only shoe words he knew. The soldier paused, fist in midair. He cocked his head to the side. "Always hit where the mark isn't looking." Jesper made a show of parting his lips and pretended to shove something between them. The soldier's eyes widened and his grip loosened as he tried to tear Jesper's hand away. The Kurgood made a sound, maybe a grunt, maybe the beginnings of a protest. It didn't much matter. With his other hand, Jesper smashed the glass vial into the soldier's open mouth. The giant flinched back as glass shards lodged in his lips and spilled over his chin, blood oozing around them. Jesper rubbed his hand furiously against his shirt, hoping he had nicked his own fingers and let in the weevil, but nothing happened. The soldier didn't seem anything but angry. He growled and seized Jesper's shoulders, lifting him off his feet. "Oh, saints," thought Jesper. "Maybe he's not going to bother taking me to his pals." He grabbed the giant's thick arms, trying to break his hold.
The Kurgood gave Jesper a shake. He coughed, big chest shuddering, and shook Jesper again, a weak, stuttering jiggle. Then Jesper realized the soldier wasn't shaking him. The soldier was just shaking. A low hiss emerged from the giant's mouth. The sound of eggs dropped onto a hot skillet. Pink foam bubbled up from his lips, a froth of blood and saliva that dribbled over his chin. Jesper recoiled. The soldier moaned. His massive hands released Jesper's shoulders, and Jesper edged backward, unable to tear his eyes away from the Kurgood as his body began to convulse, chest heaving. The soldier bent double as a stream of pink bile spewed from his lips, spattering the wall. "Missed me again," said Jesper, trying not to gag. The giant tipped sideways and toppled to the floor, still as a fallen oak. For a moment, Jesper just stared at his enormous body. Then, sense returned to him. How much time had he lost? He bolted back toward the chapels at the end of the thumbnave. Before he reached the door, Inej emerged, hurrying toward him. He'd missed the meet. She wouldn't have come after him unless she thought he was in trouble. "Jesper, where?" "Gun," he demanded. Without another word, she unslung it from her shoulder. He snatched it from her, running back toward the cathedral. If he could just make it up to the arcade. The siren sounded. Too late. He'd never make it in time. He was going to fail them all. What good is a shooter without his guns? What good was Jesper if he couldn't make the shot? They'd be trapped in the city. They'd be jailed, probably executed. Kue would be sold to the highest bidder. Perim would burn a swath through the world, and Grisha would be hunted with even more fervor. And Fierda, the Wandering Isle, Novi Zim, the Zoa would vanish, pressed into military service, devoured by this curse of a drug. The siren rose and fell. There were shouts inside the cathedral. People were running for the main doors. Soon, they'd spill over into the thumb, seeking another way out. "Anyone can shoot, but not everyone can aim." His mother's voice. "We're Zoa. You and me." Impossible. He couldn't even get eyes on Kue from here, and no one could shoot around a corner. But Jesper knew the layout of the cathedral well enough. He knew it was a straight shot up the aisle to where the auction block stood. He could see the second button of Kue's shirt in his mind's eye. Impossible. A bullet had only one trajectory. But what if that bullet could be guided? Not everybody can aim. "Jesper," said Inej from behind. He raised his rifle. It was an ordinary firearm, but he'd converted it himself. There was only a single round inside it. Non-lethal. A mixture of wax and rubber. If he missed, someone could be hurt, badly. But if he didn't shoot, a lot of people would be hurt. Hell, Jesper thought. Maybe if I miss Kue, I'll take out one of Vanek's eyes. He'd worked with gunsmiths, made his own ammunition. He knew his guns better than he knew the rules of Macher's Wheel. Jesper focused on the bullet, sensed the smallest parts of it. Maybe he was the same. A bullet in a chamber. Spending his whole life waiting for the moment when he would have direction. "Anyone can shoot." "Inej," he said, "if you have a spare prayer, this would be the time for it." He fired. It was as if time slowed. He felt the kick of the rifle, the unstoppable momentum of the bullet. With all his will, he focused on its wax casing and pulled to the left, the shot still ringing in his ears. He felt the bullet turn, focused on that button, the second button. A little piece of wood, the threads holding it in place. "It's not a gift, it's a curse." But when it came down to it, Jesper's life had been full of blessings. His father,
his mother, Inej, Nina, Matthias leading them across the muddy canal, Kaz, even Kaz, with all his cruelties and failings, had given him a home and a family in the dregs when Ketterdam might have swallowed him whole. And Wylan. Wylan, who had understood before Jesper ever had that the power inside him might be a blessing too. "What did you just do?" asked Inej. "Maybe nothing. Maybe the impossible." Jesper never could resist long odds. He shrugged. "Same thing I always do. I took a shot."
37. Kaz. Kaz had been standing next to Kuwe when the bullet struck and had been the first to his side. He heard a smattering of gunfire in the cathedral, most likely panicked stud watch officers with hasty trigger fingers. Kaz knelt over Kuwe's body, hiding his left hand from view, and jabbed a syringe into the shoe boy's arm. There was blood everywhere. Yellen Rodmacher had fallen to the stage and was bellowing, "I've been shot!" He had not been shot. Kaz shouted for the medic. The little bald man stood paralyzed beside the stage where he'd been tending to Wylan, his face horror-stricken. Matthias seized the medic's elbow and dragged him over. People were still pushing to get out of the church. A brawl had erupted between the Rofkin soldiers and the Fjerdins as Sturmhand, Zoya, and Jenya bolted for an exit. The members of the Merchant Council had surrounded Van Eck with a clutch of men from the Stadwatch. He wasn't going anywhere. A moment later, Kaz saw Inej and Jesper pushing against the tide of people trying to escape down the center aisle. Kaz let his eyes scan Inej once. She was bloody, and her eyes were red and swollen, but she seemed all right. "Kuwe," said Inej. "We can't help him now," said Kaz. "Wylan," Jesper said, taking in the cuts and rapidly forming bruises. "Saints, is that all real?" "Annika and Keeg did a number on him." "I wanted it to be believable," said Wylan. "I admire your commitment to the craft," said Kaz. "Jesper, stay with Wylan. They're going to want to question him." "I'm fine," said Wylan, though his lip was so swollen it sounded more like Ibefibe. Kaz spared a single nod for Matthias as two Stadwatch guards lifted Kuwe's body onto a stretcher. Instead of fighting the crowds in the cathedral, they headed for the arch that led to Gazin's little finger and the exit beyond. Matthias trailed them, pulling the medic along. There could be no questions surrounding Kuwe's survival. Kaz and Inej followed them into the nave, but Inej paused at the archway. Kaz saw her look once over her shoulder, and when he tracked her gaze, he saw that Van Eck, surrounded by furious councilmen, was staring right back at her. He remembered the words she'd spoken to Van Eck on Godemid Bridge. "You will see me once more, but only once." From the nervous bob of Van Eck's throat, he was remembering too. Inej gave the smallest bow. They raced up the pinky nave and into the chapel, but the door to the street and the canal beyond was locked. Behind them, the door to the chapel banged shut. Pekka Rollins leaned back against it, surrounded by four of his Dimelion crew. "Right on time," said Kaz. "I suppose you predicted this too, you tricksy bastard." "I knew you wouldn't let me walk away this time." "No," Rollins conceded. "When you came to me looking for money, I should have gutted you and your friends and saved myself a lot of hassle. That was foolish of me." Rollins began to shrug off his jacket. "I can admit I didn't show you the proper respect, lad. But now you've got it. Congratulations! You're worth the time it's going to take me to beat you to death with that stick of yours." Inej drew her knives. "No, no, little girl," Rollins said warningly. "This is between me and this skivstain upstart." Kaz nodded to Inej. "He's right. We're long overdue for a chat." Rollins laughed, unbuttoning his cuffs and rolling up his sleeves. "The time for talk is over, lad. You're young, but I've been brawling since long before you were born." Kaz didn't move. He kept his hands resting on his cane. "I don't need to fight you, Rollins. I'm going to offer you a trade. Ah, a fair exchange in the Church of Barter. You cost me a lot of money and earned me a lot of trouble with your scheming. I don't see what you could possibly have to offer that would satisfy me as much as killing you with my bare hands. It's about the Kalish Prince. 3 stories of paradise, the finest gambling den on East Stave. You plan to bomb there or something? No, I mean the little Kalish Prince. Rollin stilled. Fond of sweets, red hair like his father. Doesn't take very good care of his toys. Kaz reached into his coat and drew out a small crocheted lion. It was a faded yellow, its yarn mane tangled and stained by dark soil. Kaz let it drop to the floor. Rollin stared at it. What is that? He said, his voice little more than a whisper. Then, as if coming back to himself, he shouted, What is that? You know what it is, Rollins. And weren't you the one who told me how much alike you and Van Eck are? Men of industry, building something to leave behind. Both of you so concerned with your legacy. What good is all that if there's no one to leave it to? So I found myself asking, just who is he building for? Rollins clenched his fists, the meaty muscles of his forearms flexing, his jowls quivering. I will kill you, Brecker. I will kill everything you love. Now Kaz laughed. The trick is not to love anything, Rollins. You can threaten me all you like, you can gut me where I stand. But there's no way you'll find your son in time to save him. Shall I have him sent to your door with his throat cut and dressed in his best suit? You trifling piece of barrel trash! Rollins snarled. What the hell do you want from me? Kaz felt his humor slide away. Felt that dark door open inside of him. I want you to remember. Remember what? 7 years ago you ran a con on 2 boys from the south. Farm boys too stupid to know any better. You took us in, made us trust you, fed us hutsput with your fake wife and your fake daughter. You took our trust, and then you took our money, and then you took everything. He could see Rollins' mind working. Can't quite recall? There were so many, weren't there? How many swindles that year? How many unlucky pigeons have you conned in the time since? You have no right, Pekka said angrily. His chest rising and falling in ragged bursts, his eyes drawn again and again to the toy lion. Don't worry. Your boy isn't dead. Yet. Kaz watched Pekka's face closely. Here, I'll help. You use the name Jacob Hertzun. You made my brother a runner for you. You operated out of a coffee house. Across from the park, Pekka said quickly. The one with the cherry trees. That's it. It was a long time ago, boy. You duped us out of everything. We ended up on the streets, and then we died. Both of us in our own way. But only one of us was reborn. Is that what this has been about all this time? Why you look at me with murder in those shark's eyes of yours? Pekka shook his head. You were 2 pigeons, and I happened to be the one who plucked you. If it hadn't been me, it would have been someone else. That dark door opened wider. Kaz wanted to walk through it. He would never be whole. Geordi could never be brought back. But Pekka Rollins could learn the helplessness they'd known. Well, it was your bad luck that it was you, he bit out. Yours and your son's. I think you're bluffing. Kaz smiled. I buried your son. He crooned, savoring the words. I buried him alive, 6 feet beneath the earth in a field of rocky soil. I could hear him crying the whole time, begging for his father. Papa, Papa. I've never heard a sweeter sound. Kaz, said Inej, her face pale. This she would not forgive him. Rollins bulled toward him, grabbed him by his lapels, and slammed him against the chapel wall. Kaz led him. Rollins was sweating like a moist plum, his face livid with desperation and terror. Kaz drank it in, He wanted to remember every moment of this.
Tell me where he is, Brecker!
He smashed Kaz's head against the wall again.
Tell me!
It's a simple trade, Rollins. Just speak my brother's name and your son lives.
Brecker!
Tell me my brother's name.